The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
I prefer the tensions that exist with freedom of choice. I prefer the possibility of people moving on and choosing what they consider to be in their best interest. The transition from debtism to statism is very clear. It's where we're at. It's where we're going. We as individuals need to choose how we respond to that very carefully, very perspicaciously.
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. As everyone knows, you do a lot of traveling, Dave. You've spoken at many conferences. We have numerous conferences throughout the year. You're just getting back from a conference with the Hayek Group, but I want to talk about something in particular. Last year, when you had your conference in Austin, Texas, you met Governor Greg Abbott, and when you were talking to him, he's a fascinating guy, wheelchair-bound, which is, you know, very inspiring, but when he found out what you did and that you were involved with gold, he was very interested, and in the last couple of days, he wasn't just playing politics, was he, Dave? He actually put his money where his mouth is with gold.
Well, that's right. It's a bill, House Bill 483, which he signed just this week. And what it does is it calls for the $1 billion in gold, which the state of Texas owns, to be sent to Texas from the New York Federal Reserve. They want it in possession. And they want to be able to count their ounces.
So it's not just Holland, it's not just Germany, it's not just Austria, Venezuela. It's now Texas that are starting to say, you know, I think we'll take our gold in delivery. Thank you very much.
And a part of the bill made very clear that this gold, nor any gold of the citizens of Texas, could be confiscated by the federal government. It was just an interesting insertion into it. Late last night, I'm reading through the entire bill, over 20 pages of it, and it just, I'm reading this going, this is bold. It's very bold, but it makes sense. If you don't want your gold rehypothecated, if you want to know that it hasn't been leased out, then just take possession of it. It's very, very simple, and he's done that. I wasn't sure when I met him if he was being emotionally and relationally generous, as some politicians are, glad-handing with a warm smile and taking an interest in whatever the person is interested in that you happen to be talking to at the time. But no, he really is interested in gold. He really is interested in the fiscal solvency of the state that he's working for.
You know, Dave, don't you love it when a politician is genuine? You know, there are so many people from the strata of life, you know, that can be genuine and actually doing what they believe. You know, you told a story this morning to the group here when we had a staff meeting. You were walking through the Denver airport as you were coming or going to the Hayek Group discussion, and there was a shoeshine person who offered a shoeshine to you. I'd love you to tell the story because it has life wrapped up in it.
I reached into my pocket and realized that all I had was credit cards. And living in a cashless society, apparently, I looked up at this lady and said, I'm afraid all I have is credit cards. I don't think that's going to work for you, is it? And she looked down at my shoes, and she could tell they were in need of being polished. And she said, it works just fine. You need a shoe shine. Get on into that seat. And I said, well, I mean, I can buy you lunch. I'd be happy to. And she said, no. You just, I'll take care of it.
She did it for free because she doesn't take credit cards.
And I thought, you know, here's Colette in the Denver airport, doing what she does best. This is what she takes pride in, and she does a great job. Actually, I've never had a pair of shoes look better. And the intrinsic reward that she had from just being helpful, I think, was remarkable to me. In a world where everyone is driven by extrinsic reward, where everyone is benchmarking success and expecting X, Y, and Z out of a relationship and out of a person, it was gratuitous, it was generous, it was kind. It had left a lasting impression. I have to be honest, I don't know that I've ever thought long and hard about anyone who has shined my shoes before, and perhaps I should. But Colette left a lasting impression. In her mid to late 60s, from France, and with a lot of life in her eyes, seeing that her story runs deep, some of it glorious, beautiful, and some of it tragic too. And, you know, here she is shining my shoes, and I can't pay her at that moment. and she's happy to do it. And again, I just wonder about a world that is driven by extrinsic reward only, because here is a woman who exemplified for me a deep level of satisfaction in what she did, regardless of what she got for it. I don't know what else to say.
Well, and you know, you were encouraging the guys and gals here at the office, because we all want to be driven to fill a need because there's a need, not to earn money. Or, you know, you've got to earn money to live, but that shouldn't be our driving goal. And, you know, I'm going to shift to the economy here because that's obviously what we talk about often, but I'm looking at the actions of the Federal Reserve. I'm looking at this unhealthy relationship between Wall Street, the Federal Reserve, and Washington, and how there's a very small fraction of the people. They're becoming extraordinarily wealthy. But the rest of the people right now are wondering why it is that they can't meet the end of the month with savings.
Well, certainly, when you're dealing with a world and a business and financial environment with a zero cost to money, things begin to behave very differently, very differently. And there are those who benefit from there being a zero cost to money, and there are others who suffer from it. And actually, there is some confusion about that point. You know, as I traveled to Reno last week, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal which stood out. It was written by a former McIlvany Weekly commentary guest, Ben Steele. Of course, his real claim to fame is working and writing for the CFR. And I hear from him several times a month, read his thoughts regularly. So the article was in the Wall Street Journal rehashing something that he's been chewing on for a while. The FOMC Committee of 12, the Federal Open Markets Committee, with their much anticipated votes, of course, they're meeting again this week, their deliberations, they're really no longer the seat of power when it comes to raising rates.
They're not really making the decision, are they? There's just a handful of people, and almost all of those are leaning towards leaving rates low.
His argument, in a nutshell, is that if you look at the interest paid on reserves, that is, excess reserves of depository institutions held at the Fed, that number and the interest that is paid is more important to the rise in rates than anything that the FOMC does. And there is a group of five, the Board of Governors, that makes the decision what will or will not be paid on those excess reserves. Most of those on the Board of Governors are dovish and therefore unlikely to raise rates anytime soon. And this is important because the market believes that the signal comes from the more balanced group of doves and hawks on the FOMC, the larger group of people, rather than the Board of Governors. So you've got Powell, Brainard, Tarullo, Fisher, Yellen, and four of these members here in the last 10 days have been discussing the merits of waiting well into 2016. So you've got the crowd who says, oh no, we'll see a raise in rates this September. Maybe and maybe not, but make sure you're looking at the actual decision makers as opposed to the puppets in the Kabuki theater.
Well, and we're getting a mixed message because, you know, we both get the Economist magazine in this week's cover, the June 13th to 19th cover says, watch out. The world is not ready for the next recession. And it shows a picture of a guy walking from one slain dragon into the mouth of another slain dragon. Yet what's interesting is we're being told we can't raise rates. Now, why is that?
One of the main articles in this week's Economist argues that we have every reason to accept the recovery story.
I love that they call it the recovery story.
Yeah, and with good evidence stacking up in favor of it. So against any kind of economic slump on the horizon, we don't see that. That's not how the evidence stacks up. It's pro-growth. It's the economy has recovered. Look at the markets. But as they end the piece, it's very interesting because I felt like 2.5 pages was cheerleading for, listen, you can't question the evidence. Here it is. As they close the piece, they say, but let's keep interest rates on the floor a little bit longer. And the reasons?
Just in case.
And it's this, the poor and the middle class need a boost from lower rates. That was how they concluded the article. The poor and the middle class need a boost from lower rates because they are still in what is known as a balance sheet recession. They don't have assets that are appreciating. They have debt that is still burdening them. They don't have sufficient income to make payments on it. Therefore, we need to keep interest rates low enough to help the poor and the middle class. And honestly, at times, I think to myself, either the world is going mad or I am, because there is a true, right here, there is a true disconnect between the Fed's actions and the real-world consequences of those actions with the obvious dots left to hang detached. How it escapes the purview of economists and writers, I don't know. But the free money line, this is a very, very short line. And the only people in the free money line are the ones who are privileged enough to buy their place in it.
Well, and I think it's important to understand, too, whenever someone prints money, you cannot create value out of thin air. You can create paper money. And ultimately, the more paper money you create, the less valuable it is. I mean, that's just an axiom of nature. But the thing is, it's a form of theft, because for the person who doesn't get the free money, they're losing, they're not gaining.
Well, right. You've got the stimulus created by a zero rate policy, which flows through to the owners of assets. So here is a multi-trillion dollar boost to the U.S. equity market, the real estate market, the art market, which has had an obvious benefit to some households, but has not relieved the middle class of a sustained balance sheet recession where there's too much debt, too little income, and it's driving households to the point of frustration or even desperation. So here this article is arguing, hey, everything's fine. We're good. Two thumbs up. Let's go full systems ahead. But we should probably keep the life support, this regular feed of zero interest rates, going a little bit longer because, well, we still want to help the little guy. And again, you're boosting the value of assets. That's fine as long as you're the asset owner. But if not, I think you need to be careful. Fed policy is what is, in fact, setting the stage for class warfare. We've seen number periods in history where you have two economies existing side by side with massive disparities and what appears to be injustice and unjust weight and measures. And in fact, that is the cause. It is more than an appearance. The world of fiat currencies is fueling the financialization of the economy, and it's shifting an emphasis from entrepreneurial wealth creation to currency recycling, investment, trading, and gambling, where, again, you have two separate worlds, the real economy and the financialized economy.
You know, and I look at societies that get to that class warfare, and it becomes revolutionary. It can change the system completely. You know, you look at the Tsarist Russia time of Nicholas II. They were so disconnected, Dave, from the actual strains of the people that it led to a revolution. Unfortunately, it led to communism and just really had the makings of destroying an entire people. It led to tens of millions of deaths over the last century. And really, it boils down to these two economies running side by side until it no longer worked.
The French had a common practice. After each meal, they would take their extraordinarily expensive dinner sets and throw them out the window and allow them to crash below because we could, because the money was no object. And that was the era that saw heads roll. That was the era where the excess was told on the street corners and in the alleyways. And those people were resented. They were hated. They ultimately were vilified to the point where extraordinarily terrible things happened to them in the name of justice. And I understand that that's a perversion of justice, but sociologically, these problems emerge when you don't handle your money well. And that's, in fact, what we're doing. We're seeing the mishandling of money open up the door to major social dislocation.
Well, and we're being told the same people who are throwing the dishes out the window, so to speak, okay, are the same people who actually report to us what consumer price index is and how life really is not that much tougher than it was going back to the year 2000. You know, they say, well, judging from the CPI, cost of living has only really increased about 5%. Yeah, since the year 2000. That's the report.
Now, according to George Gilder, with the CPI, again, you're right, 5% is the decline in income for the average family since the year 2000 to the present, if you factor in the normal CPI. What George does is he comes along and he references what can be called the Walmart CPI. So this is inclusive of the costs that represent a family's typical consumption needs. And according to a Walmart CPI, which doesn't cut out a lot of the things that American families do in fact spend money on, incomes since the year 2000 are down by 17% in the same period.
That's more realistic.
So again, here you have sort of the two-tier income stratas where incomes have never been higher amongst the billionaire class, and incomes are getting lower and lower amongst the lower middle class and the poor in our country. And again, this is not sort of a bleeding heart argument for how to solve injustice. It is just to point out the fact that the injustice is there, but it's not there for the reasons that are touted. You know, you've got Elizabeth Warren and Hillary Clinton, and they can pretend that it's the hedge fund traders to blame for the wide gap between the rich and the poor.
This is actually right after they throw the dishes out the window, right?
Right, exactly. Yeah. But, you know, when you look at the causal chain, you have financial operators who are simply reaping what the Fed has sown. And so with a zero cost to money, quite frankly, you'd be crazy not to get as much of it as possible and gamble with it while the game goes on. And this, I think, is part of the disconnect. I don't think you should blame human nature for playing by the rules and getting rich in the process. But you can keep a criticism firmly in place and blame the rulemakers for naively thinking that they can not only govern the economy, but more specifically control human nature and choice via monetary policy. And by the way, there's massive consequences to that. And again, this is the disparity between rich and poor. They're not willing to connect those dots.
Well, and one of the reasons households are not spending is because they're insecure. They are coming to the end of the month and going, you know what, we may not make it next month. And so when the government says, well, what we need to do is drive spending, well, spending what?
Inflation has an interesting way of playing on our insecurities because it's not something that we fully grasp. You can't see it in real time, but you do feel it at the end of the month, the end of the year, where you feel and you know that you've had to make adjustments to your finances and your spending habits because the money's not going quite as far. So yes, households are saving now out of a basic level of insecurity, while on the other hand, the 0.1% in our economy continue to reap the biggest payday ever as the markets have become something of a casino. And why wouldn't they put more money into those casino-like markets when the odds have been improved? Right. And I think one of the things that we will find is that this is actually wrecking capital formation and stymieing entrepreneurship. Next week, we're going to migrate our conversation towards an old equation, MV equals PT.
Yeah, when you look at it on paper, MV equals PT is one of the most beautifully simple equations. And we're drawn to simplicity. I mean, this is Milton Friedman's famous equation that really has been used over the last 30 years or so.
And you're basically looking at money supply times velocity.
And prices times transactions.
Well, exactly. So, which is basically the economy. So money and velocity equals the economic results on the other side of the equation.
Right. And you're going to talk about it next week, but I think it's important to note anytime you have an equation that you want to adjust one area of, you do need to have a constant, something that you can count on in the other part of the equation, or else it becomes meaningless.
Right. And so the central planners have failed to move the economic needle. And a part of that is because they've used M, or the money supply, and focused on what they can do to increase or decrease the money supply to stimulate aggregate demand. That's what they're trying to do, is influence M. And they've assumed that V, velocity, is fairly constant. Now, in light of a failed attempt to influence the money supply and thus goose the economy higher, they're shifting their focus to velocity. In recent weeks, you know, we just passed the D-Day remembrance where V, I guess if you wanted to think of it rhetorically, V is for victory.
Sure.
You remember that?
Oh, yeah.
Next week, what we'll do is explore V, or velocity of money, as an expression of choice and freedom.
Right, because velocity basically is a person saying, well, yes, I'm going to spend on that today, or no, I'm going to save and spend on something else tomorrow.
In which case, velocity would fall. So I asked our listeners to read the article by Ken Rogoff relating to shifting towards a cashless society, because what we have here is an ideologically driven trend among central planners to defend their worldview in spite of failure to perform. Again, when you focus on monetary supply and it doesn't work, when you say, hey, listen, it's our job to step in an emergency and spend like there's no tomorrow, create credit, and make sure that we goose the economy to keep things going, the presumption is that you're going to see a tremendous amount of economic activity on the other side. And that has not happened. So where is GDP growth that has matched our monetary expansion? There has been none. So this is the problem. And this is why I say they're now shifting emphasis towards a new means of controlling human behavior and thus the economy.
Forcing you to spend. We've talked about this. The cashless society, charging tax possibly on savings, zero interest rates or negative interest rates. These are all things trying to force people to spend and not save.
And it goes back to that basic equation. They've focused on M for too long, realize it's not working, so now they're going to focus on V and see if they can't salvage their worldview in the course of manipulating and controlling human behavior. We're talking about limiting limiting freedoms in the context of a cashless society.
You know, it reminds me of, Dave, in the old Charlton Heston movie, The Ten Commandments, when they took the straw away from the people and made them make bricks, but they got the whips out to make them make bricks. They're taking straw away, but they're making them produce more. And, you know, I know that sounds like an aggravation, but it's more than aggravation. Like I said, it's outright theft.
We're going to discuss this and a couple of other issues next week with social commentator and technologist George Gilder. We've talked about being late in the business cycle. In other words, having gone through a long stretch and sort of being at the very end of a business cycle. We've discussed the Fed's attempts to prevent an inevitable, and in fact, what we would view as healthy decline in order to smooth out the business cycle and prevent a divergence from a path of steady progress, which they assume is theoretically possible. We've discussed the share buyback program as indicative of the inability of corporations to grow organically. And so now they're resorting to engineering results, which keep shareholders on board and, of course, deliver bigger bonuses to your C-suites, your chief executives in the building.
Well, and Gilder focuses on, this is not economic productivity, Dave. I mean, if you have a healthy economy, you have what they call IPOs, initial public offerings, new ideas, things to drive an economy. When you have a contraction, you've got these share buybacks and you have, well, simply companies mergers and acquisitions and coming together. They're not really creating anything new. They're just consolidating and rebuying their own shares.
Well, right. So Gilder supports the conclusions that we've come to that we're very late in a business cycle, a massive credit cycle, in fact, by looking at the number of initial public offerings, new businesses that are going public in the decade leading up to 2000. He compares that to mergers and acquisitions. And you had 20 initial public offerings for every one merger or acquisition.
Which shows new ideas coming into the economy.
Exactly. And then what you have now is one IPO for every eight merger and acquisition deals. So it's shifted dramatically from new ideas, creativity, the possibility of failure, to entrenched businesses capturing market share, not being able to grow except by what I would say is cannibalizing existing companies to create sort of a patchwork quilt of corporate value. And it's very different than a new idea, a new company, a new innovation being offered, which is in fact what increases employment and brings about sort of the legendary Schumpeterian creative destruction, keeping markets fresh and entrepreneurial.
Well, a business should be willing to succeed. And a business or the economy should be willing to let some businesses fail. That's this Schumpeterian creative destruction that you're talking about. When Schumpeter talked about that, you can't have something unhealthy just continually sustained. It ultimately ends in death. And I'm going to give you an example. Okay, we had a hummingbird feeder.
Before you go there, if you guarantee success, you in essence are guaranteeing failure as well. There's no way to come into a market if someone else is entrenched and defended by government largesse.
Right.
So it doesn't allow for new ideas to come in. I mean, that's the problem is when you come into a command and control orientation in an economy where the powers that be say, we have to protect this industry, we're going to support it financially, not going to allow it to fail. What it means is, in effect, no new innovative ideas can come into that area.
Mm-hmm.
Why? Because they can't afford to survive with competition that's subsidized.
And it ultimately kills even the subsidized business because you can't do that for forever. And I was going to use a hummingbird feeder as an example. You know, living down here in Durango, Colorado, I don't know anything about hummingbirds, but they migrate. And if you leave the feeder out and continue to feed the hummingbirds, they won't leave. And ultimately, they die in the winter. It's very, very important here. We learned when we moved down here that you take that hummingbird feeder down about the third week in August because you need those hummingbirds to start to get hungry, start to think, okay, it's time to move on. Ultimately, it saves the bird's life. If you would have fed them through the winter, you'd kill them. That's where you see in this economy where you have the privileged few who really have no business risk because they're going to be bailed out no matter what they do.
Next week, as we talk with George Gilder, part of the inquiry will be to see what role the Fed has had in stultifying innovation and setting the tone for a capitalist malaise where new and fresh ideas are less common than sort of the new versions of cleverness that are required to sort of engineer financial success for the purpose of sort of keeping up appearances. Mm-hmm. The corporate sector looks healthy today in large part because of what has been engineered financially. And the consequence is that we're actually gutting the capital markets. Now just think about that again. 20-1, the IPOs to merger and acquisition deals in the context of an economy that's going bonkers and arguably moving towards a bubble phase, but still with new ideas being generated. Now you have one IPO for every 8 merger acquisition. And again, when you're at the end of a growth cycle and you can't increase sales or invest in future research and development to seed your success down the line, you resort to corporate cannibalism.
Right.
So corporate cannibalism is our version, modern day version. Call it mergers and acquisitions. That's certainly more polite. But it's like the LBO. Do you remember the leveraged buyout days in the 1980s?
No, sure.
You had massive debt, which was allowing for the minnows in a market to swallow whales. And we were then, and we are today, setting ourselves up for trouble.
You know, the thing is, we have talked about how dangerous this is that corporations are doing this. The mergers and acquisitions, the buybacks, this cannibalization. But along comes the government and they say, yes, you are exactly right. We now need to regulate this. We now need to put a stop to this. That can actually, even though it sounds like it's right thinking, it can actually ruin the whole system, can't it?
Right. And the problem is they are the creators of the problem. And it's very difficult to be the solver of a problem when you're also the creator of the problem.
But now it's time for more regulation to solve the problem you created.
And I understand there's a distinction between the Fed and government. But if the Fed is going to create a problem in terms of malinvestment, and then the government's going to come along and say, thank you for creating the liquidity we needed, and we're not going to assume that that's connected with the consequences of malinvestment, now we're going to regulate the heck out of the markets to solve the problem created by malinvestment. It's foolishness.
It's insanity.
Our friend Bill King reminds us that as Senator Tammy Baldwin and Elizabeth Warren are now beginning sort of down the war path, their focus is on share buybacks. And listen, it's with good reason in mind. The costs of changing an unhealthy system, they're very grave. Does it need to be changed? Yes. How and when does it happen? That has to be looked at very carefully. And I'm not a proponent of regulation to solve this particular problem, because I think you're talking about monetary largesse, which is driving it, not necessarily bad human behavior. Corporations are going to do what they think is in their best interest to do in light of the context which they live in. That context has been created by the Fed. So they are existing in an artificial reality. Change the artificial reality. Take away the Fed's monetary largesse and you begin to see a different set of corporate choices.
Well, you know, you think about what was created almost 30 years ago. Okay, the tax breaks for limited partnerships. And then when Rostenkowski came in and changed all that, it eliminated about 40% of the financial planning community because they had based everything on that model. And then the government changed the model.
Changed the model, changed the rules, and everything looking back was destroyed. Dan Rostenkowski, he was the chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and in large part, he precipitated the 1987 crash when he warned that tax deductions for interest expense would be withdrawn for leveraged buyouts, LBOs, and acquisitions. That, as Bill King has suggested, occurred the Wednesday prior to October 19th, 1987, when he had the market crash.
Dave, actually, come to think of it, those were two separate events. Okay, the Rostenkowski thing, that preceded the crash of the stock market. But even before that, real estate limited partnerships had been given huge tax breaks. The government gave it to them for a few years, and then all of a sudden, whack, they took them away, and they grandfathered back, and they wanted taxes for the time that they had given the advantage. This is where regulation destroys a market, and this is where so many people lost everything.
One of our good family friends, real estate developer, Ferrari racing, red-blooded real estate developer, he was good at what he did, has made and lost many fortunes. And this was a critical period of time for him where, again, the rules changed and expectations changed, and then there had to be an adjustment to market values in light of the change in rules. So you've got Warren, you've got Baldwin, that is Tammy Baldwin and Elizabeth Warren, who want to explore right now the legitimacy of tax deductions on the debt used to buy back shares. And again, this is from a 13-page letter to the SEC, and they're crying foul. We've hit this topic all year long with buybacks, and that is, not only is there a manipulation of earnings per share via the buyback schemes, but the huge corporate debt binge which has funded a good portion of those share buybacks. You've got Bloomberg, who quotes a Goldman Sachs official this week, saying that the deductions on that debt are pretty sizable. Let's just look at this as sort of a theoretical sequence in play.
Let's just play a thought experiment. Let's go from beginning to end on this. Let's say, all right, how did it start and how did it progress? And now how does the government solve it? You said they started the problem. How do they solve it? So give me a hypothetical.
Yeah, if they change tax deductions for corporations on debt, it's a very significant issue. And yes, it can precipitate the kind of market gyrations we had in the late 80s with a single day crash of over 20%. But how does that play out? What is the sequence? Well, so you've got the Fed. They induce bad behavior or malinvestment via zero interest rate policies and their various rounds of quantitative easing, buying up assets, adulterating their balance sheet to do so. Then you've got the system, okay? It gets used to its market. Do you remember in Aldous Huxley's A Brave New World, what he called SOMA?
Right.
Kind of a little bit of drugs to keep things going and keep everyone happy. So the market gets used to its SOMA from the Fed in the form of free money and downside market protection. And that downside market protection comes in the form of either verbal or actual market interventions. And as a result of this, there is volatility, which is completely tamed, and then complacency in the market becomes pervasive. Does this sound like what we already have?
Sure, no uncertainty.
And then everyone is surprised when a change in rules rocks the naive expectations of market participants. The Fed actually doesn't control the market. I thought they set us on an unalterable course towards higher levels and higher prices. And this is the oops moment. The oops moment is when leveraged players are forced to adjust to the new reality. And in the process of sobering up a little bit, guess what they have to do?
They're going to have to sell assets.
They do. So you sell off assets, which in turn triggers a downward spiral in price as you have limit orders triggered, and prices decline more rapidly than anticipated. So now you've got institutions and market makers who basically say, we're not going to provide liquidity, either stocks or bonds. We're not interested in being the warehouse for things that are in free fall.
Well, and don't forget the margin. Okay, the margin just adds to that.
Right, the margin buyers who bought assets that they couldn't afford and now have to not only pay back the loan, but take a loss on the investment. Add to that, again, this is just a theoretical crisis in play. Derivative players, they take a major hit. And you have a variety of financial institutions that were basically playing the insurance game. What is that exactly? Playing the insurance game is collecting premiums for protecting investors against a market decline, never expecting to pay out on the claims because, again, it's something of a rigged game. As long as the Fed has your back, as long as you have the Greenspan put in play.
There's no such thing as a black swan if they've got your back.
Right. So now you've got market declines that were never expected, and you're actually paying out claims which start to pressure the solvency of those institutions. How? Well, again, if you don't have enough liquidity, then you have your solvency put right into question. Liquidity issues, once again, become solvency issues. And this is the second time in 10 years. And it circles back around to two things, the shortness of memory in Wall Street and the permanence of greed amongst bankers. And this is where we continue to see the Fed say, no, we're here to fix the system, save the system, help you, when in fact, they're destroying the capital markets. They're destroying the capital markets by creating a casino-like environment where people assume that they can lever up, borrow money to invest in things they couldn't afford otherwise, to enhance returns thereby, and know that there's no downside in the market.
Well, and there are so many moving parts. If you remember our guest that we've had several times and you've gone out to see in New York, Richard Buchstaber, he wrote a book called A Demon of Our Own Design. It was a fabulous book based on complex systems. He looked at the shuttle program and how when you've got a million parts that have to work correctly, if you change one, it can change an awful lot of other things. And he looked at Chernobyl. One little variable changed everything. And he looked at the market and he said, you know what? When you have a complex system, one change can bring it all down.
You have to look and honestly say the cause of a financial crisis is excess credit. What actually triggers a crisis environment and event can be anything. And that's what I'm suggesting, is that whether it's Tammy Baldwin or Elizabeth Warren or, you know, 13-page letter, the SEC following through and beginning to look at that, Congress saying, hey, wait a minute, we're going to disallow a tax break. There's no way we're going to continue to allow corporations to do this, adulterate their balance sheet, compromise the capital markets. They may not be thinking that reasonably. They may have a different set of reasons. It may have to do with fairness and injustice. justice and the rich and the poor and how we're just accelerating a trend towards greater income disparity. I don't know how it's going to be woven into a narrative.
Right. So it's a good decision, possibly at a bad, bad time.
Exactly. Remember October 19th, 1987. Remember Rostenkowski. And remember that Elizabeth Warren and Tammy Baldwin may be the precipitating event in this case. Again, it doesn't even matter what the precipitating event is. When you have excess credit, this is the classic von Meissian boom to bust cycle. We're still living off of the boom phase. But again, we talked about mergers and acquisitions. We talked about that being an indication, an increase in mergers and acquisitions being an indication of being late in a credit cycle. What happens when you get to the end of a credit cycle like this? If you change one variable, in a complex system, as you mentioned with Chernobyl, the system often doesn't know how to adjust.
We call it a meltdown.
There's too many things to change. The system seizes. It's like an overworked engine. All along it's working, and then all of a sudden it doesn't.
Well, and the derivatives market is supposed to be this insurance market, but you know, I'm looking at the European markets right now. They're still sitting fairly comfortable with these derivative hedges on, saying, well, whatever happens with Greece, what will happen with Greece?
Well, right. The European markets, they have their own potential seizures. And you're right, because there's insurance against decline. These are the hedges which protect against a market loss in the case that something bad happens triggered by Greece deciding to exit the euro. And I think you need to watch very carefully the French and German banks. Watch the French and German banks. There is still at least $160 billion in Greek exposure left. And you may say, well, those French and German banks have done a good job offsetting their exposure with derivatives. You have to remember that derivatives don't eliminate risk. They just shift it. And this was a part of what we talked about with Richard Buchstaber, is you don't, in fact, eliminate risk. You just reapportion it. And you say, okay, I'm not willing to take this slice of risk, but if you're willing to buy it, I'll pay a premium for you to carry that market risk. And so it's just an offloading of risk onto someone else. Watch the French and German banks. There's $160 billion of Greek exposure if something happens to Greece in the next few days or weeks. $160 billion, someone's on the hook for it.
Well, and watch what the leaders of those banks are doing. I mean, the executives, the upper management, are they staying put or are they migrating?
Well, right. It is worth looking at the number of executives leaving Deutsche Bank here in the last few weeks, either being asked to leave or, frankly, like rats getting off the ship. It makes you wonder what's happening under the waterline. So you've got national politics in Greece and in Germany. They point to dissolving the bonds of monetary relationship. On the other hand, you've got international politics, which still may trump. And this is where you have the U.S., which fears losing a NATO ally. And Merkel, in the end, may need support from the U.S. on a number of issues relating to energy and relating to Russia and regional military cohesiveness. And therefore, she may step in and appease the Greeks with a massive debt forgiveness or restructuring. And we'll have to see how that plays out, because certainly it's become very popular amongst the Germans to say, just let them go. Let them go. So she would have to deflect some responsibility if, in fact, she wants to be reelected. Maybe the ECB takes its lumps on that front.
Well, Dave, before we wrap up, I'd like to shift to, you know, some of the questions that were asked when you were speaking for the Hayek Group. We found in doing this show that sometimes you find out where the itch is with the people when you just listen to where they need to be scratched. And the questions that they were asking, I'd like you to just bring up a couple of the things that were on the minds of the people right after you spoke.
Yeah. The dollar's reserve currency that featured prominently as I went table to table and discussed with a number of people who attended, a very engaged, a very politically active group. I was very impressed.
So the question was, what is the future of the dollar as a reserve currency?
That's correct. And sort of with the background thought being, are we witness to a currency regime change in our lifetime? Not unlike what we saw following World War I, not unlike what we saw with the collapse of the Bretton Woods system in 1971. Are we, in a 100-year stretch, seeing the third regime change, which would have a direct impact on a U.S. person in this way. You denominate your savings, you denominate your assets, you denominate your income, all in U.S. dollars. Dollar instability equals instability to your financial well-being and livelihood. So I get it. I mean, a group of people who's deeply interested in economic theory is asking a market-related question because it deals with their own personal viability. It's where economic theory, the rubber, meets the road there in the marketplace, which is what we've been discussing all day. You do have to connect economic theory with the practice of the decisions being made and the consequences that are meted out in the marketplace. The other question that I had come up a number of times was relating to student loans and the concern with a $1.2 to $1.3 trillion problem.
Well, Hillary's talking about this too. In the last several days, Hillary's starting to use this as a hammer to swing during her election campaign walk.
Right. When you're competing for the Democratic limelight, you have to prove that you are left of someone. And being too far right is not going to help you in this particular election.
Well, and you got to show that you can feel their pain because, you know, when you're worth over $100 million, you got to show that you do feel pain of student loans.
Which I'm not sure how she does. I'm sure her daughter doesn't. But, you know, there is this idea of a forgiveness of student debt, which the millennials and Generation X, I think, young professionals who are still paying off student loans, would be certainly open to the idea. It's important to realize, again, this is economic theory, which if you're looking at it from a practical and moral standpoint, if you're paying student loans, you may say, well, that sounds good to me. But understand how that sounds to everyone else, because it's taxpayers who would end up picking up your obligation.
Debt forgiven is merely debt shifted to somebody else's back.
Exactly, exactly. And so you've had that amount in student loans more than double in the last 8 years, and it doesn't look like it's slowing down. To me, it's an indication of a generation who says, I don't know what I'm going to do when I get out of college. There's not many job opportunities. And since the 60-plus set is concerned about their healthcare costs and is, in fact, staying on and working longer and not retiring because they can't afford their healthcare costs if they don't continue to work, guess what? There's actually not many job openings for my age group. Why don't I just go back to school? It advertises well. What are you getting a master's degree in? What's your double major in? Why are you staying on an extra year or two?
Right.
It's because there's not very many job opportunities for millennials.
You know, I was talking to a friend of mine who's going for her doctorate. And, you know, I've talked to a number of people who are continuing in school. They're going on and getting their master's. They're working toward a doctorate. But I usually test somebody. I don't mean to be mean, but I test somebody when they're going for a doctorate. I want to find out what their passion is. What is their thesis? Why are they going for a doctorate? Why are they taking that kind of time? And this friend of mine, it was really impressive because she knew exactly. She's driven by passion. It had nothing to do with money. It had everything to do with being able to teach people her thesis. And she knew what she was going to write about long ago. Yet I meet so many people right now that are doing what you said. They're continuing in school because, by gosh, they don't know what else to do. They can't get a job. They can't get a job that feeds a family. And so their thought is the more education, I guess, the more chance of moving forward with really no passion for what they do. A little like the story of Colette in the beginning. She cleaned your shoes for free, David, because she wanted to serve. She wanted to meet a need.
Every time I go through the Denver airport, I will find her.
Yeah.
And my shoes are perfect. I've never seen a better job.
Mm-hmm.
And it will be well worth her while. But she didn't do it for the possibility of having a loyal customer in the future. She did it because there was intrinsic reward. She does a great job. And she saw a need and she took care of it. You know, I think of the student loan issue again, and it's not as if there's an easy solution for debt forgiveness. Restructuring is more likely, putting it on terms that anyone can afford, extending loans for 100 years and making your payment on a per month basis, something like $10, something that is non-burdensome to the current generation, allows them to move on and become home buyers, et cetera, and consumers, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and living in debt is the new norm. I mean, this is the paradigm. In fact, sometimes it's even encouraged. If you're not going into debt, what's wrong with you?
Well, I think that was a part of the unspoken motivation for expanding house ownership in the United States. And I remember my manager at Morgan Stanley. I learned a lot from Fred Martin. I have great respect for him. But shortly after giving me a private office, he suggested that I buy a Porsche. It was the car that he drove. And the model that he recommended, yes, I would have borrowed to buy it. if I was going to do it. And of course, I didn't. But he put it in terms of you deserve it. And the reality within that microculture was this. Debt ties people in and locks them down. It makes their choices more predictable. And central planners prefer it as much as Fred Martin preferred it because he wanted to see my future with the firm. You have a slower turnover once you've locked people in. That's not my preference. That's certainly not how we manage this office or our lives. I prefer the tensions that exist with freedom of choice. I prefer the possibility of people moving on and choosing what they consider to be in their best interest. Unencumbered. But it's interesting that debt features so prominently in our society today. And we are at this point where, as Richard Duncan has suggested, and as I suggested to the folks in Reno last week, the transition from debtism to statism is very clear. It's where we're at. It's where we're going. We as individuals need to choose how we respond to that very carefully, very perspicaciously.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com. Or just give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.